Neuroplasticity is now in its second generation of research. The long-held science that the brain is hardwired and fixed lives no more. People are proving every day that their brains are restructuring to overcome adversity and facilitate a better life. Psychoanalytic researcher Dr. Norman Doidge has a finger on this pulse and shares it in his book, The Brain's Way of Healing. And he is with us for the next 2 weeks. So stay tuned. I'm Robin Clare. This is Tributaries. Early brain research assumed the brain was fixed, and of course now, as we've learned, we're now in the second generation of researchers doing neuroplasticity, and the healing mechanisms are so telling. I'm wondering that, are we out now of the conquest phase? Has this led us into being out of that war mentality for healing, and what maybe is important about that?
The war mentality for healing. Well, let me say a few words about that. And unfortunately, I don't think we are. Modern medicine began with modern science, and modern science is very much unlike ancient science. Ancient science is conceived of by people like Aristotle, saw that one of the fundamental purposes of human life was just to understand the world, and science was about understanding. And with modern science, that changed, and science became very much about conquering nature, to improve our state, to quote Francis Bacon, for the relief of man's estate. And this idea of conquest of nature really colored the beginning of modern medicine. So, and it's with us today. But, you know, one of the first modern physicians, Thomas Sydenham, who was the English Hippocrates, you know, spoke about a vast army of diseases arrayed against us, and that he would have to attack them, murder them, kill them to get rid of them. And we still think of medicine very much as a war, the war on cancer, the, you know, combating heart disease, defeating AIDS. This metaphor affects our treatments. We first spoke of drugs as magic bullets. They're like weaponry, and the physician speaks of his or her therapeutic armamentarium in this battle. And there's a time for that war metaphor, I think, in medicine, particularly something like emergency medicine, where if, you know, you pop a blood vessel in your brain, you want a neurosurgeon with nerves of steel to go in there, cut, invade, attack. It's also led us to think that the kinds of treatments we need are like high-tech invasive weaponry. And it's even influenced, I believe, the way doctors talk to patients, because really, when you go to the doctor in this military metaphor, you as a patient are just there because your body is the battlefield upon which this extraordinary confrontation between the doctor and the disease is waged. And you're passive in the outcome. Again, there are times when this metaphor makes sense. But what it's done is it's rendered patients passive in their care, which turns out to be really important when you're treating a lot of neurological, brain, and psychiatric issues, and other issues as well. And it's even influenced how we as doctors talk to our patients. You know, I'm sorry to say, but I think everybody knows that this is very frequently, all too often, true, that we often interrupt our patients increasingly because we don't even sometimes even touch them because we're much more interested in their lab test than their narrative. So that's the military metaphor in medicine. The term was introduced by a colleague, a former dean of medicine at McGill University, Abraham Fuchs, who first described this. Now, the treatments I describe in The Brain's Way of Healing are all non-invasive, and they all deal with the brain. And it may be hard to imagine that you could deal with some pretty serious brain conditions. And let me name a few that I talk about new improvements for. It may be hard to believe that you can actually improve some of these conditions in a non-invasive way. But multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, traumatic brain injury, age-related cognitive decline, attention deficit disorder, autism, sensory processing disorders, dyslexias and learning disorders, chronic pain. Those are a number of the disorders that the second generation of neuroplasticians have developed new interventions for, all non-invasive. But I still think that, you know, when I drive by the hospitals downtown, of course, there's always talk about conquering this disease and defeating that disease. The military metaphor is alive and well.
Let's start with chronic pain. As you mentioned, all of those things in your book, and I would even like to move away from saying that it's hard to believe, because your book certainly proves it's not hard to believe. And that's certainly the beauty of all of this work that's going on. And your book is not just for anyone with a problem. It's not just for doctors. It's just a very humanitarian inspiration is at its base. It certainly is that. And chronic pain is now, through the work of many researchers and doctors, being looked at as something to cure and not just manage. And I'm wondering if you would share about how that came to be.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for that, because people often say, oh, these things seem miraculous. And what I'm trying to do is actually show that they're not miraculous, that they make sense if you understand you have the right model of the brain. So just a few things just to back up a bit so that listeners will understand. The subtitle of the book is that it's about things that have been discovered on the frontiers of neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity is that property of the brain, fairly recently discovered, that shows that the neurons in the brain and the brain overall can change its structure and function in response to mental experience and activity. What we do with our brains can significantly shape the circuitry of the brain. It had been thought for about 100 years that the brain was like a machine, an electrical machine, with hardwired circuits, meaning that the circuits of the brain were genetically predetermined and formed and finalized in childhood. And that meant that if you were born with cerebral palsy or a stroke or a learning disorder, or if later in life you had a stroke or some kind of serious brain problem, there was nothing that could be done by definition, because the brain was hardwired, and if you lost it, you couldn't get it back or work around it in a significant way. And the discovery of that the brain is plastic turns all of that on its head, and it shows that the brain isn't by definition always unchangeable. It can be modified, and even thought and activity can modify that. Okay, so to pain. I go into detail about the work of a really extraordinary clinician, Dr. Michael Moskowitz. He was a psychiatrist turned pain physician, and he had two very personal experiences that triggered his discoveries in dealing with chronic pain. The first one is Moskowitz, who's a very Huck Finnish kind of person, when he was in middle age, long past when he should be doing this, on the 4th of July, just before the 4th of July parade in San Rafael, California, had heard that there were some tanks for a military parade being stored in the city, near the city dump. And what he chose to do was climb up on one of those tanks with a friend. And as he jumped off it, his corduroy pants caught on a piece of metal sticking out, and he heard three popping sounds, and that was the sound of his femur, the longest bone in his leg, cracking. And as he lay there, his life at risk, because he was bleeding so much into his thigh that his thigh was now as wide as his waist. As he lay there waiting for the ambulance, he was a 10 out of 10 pain, the way pain physicians measure it. That's like being dropped in boiling oil. But he noticed, funnily enough, that if he could stay completely still for a minute, his pain actually dropped to a zero. And this is something he'd been teaching people all the time. There are switches in the brain that can turn off pain. Pain is there, acute pain is there, when you have injury to a limb, and it's telling you, don't move, you could further injure it. So acute pain's a warning signal. And the leading theory at the time was that there are gates or switches in the nervous system, in the spinal cord, all the way up to the brain that can turn it off. And he thought, my God, I've been teaching my students this all the time, but now that I've experienced it, I understand it's really real. The brain, pain is in the brain, it's not in the limb, and if you can turn off the switch, you can turn off the pain. And he realized, my goodness, I've been using drugs and injections with anesthetic and all sorts of things to do that, but my brain can do this. Anyway, thank God he was saved, nearly lost his life. That was the first lesson. Switches exist in the brain. The second one was, again, maybe when he shouldn't have been doing it, he was doing a kind of water skiing on an inflatable tube with his daughters. He flipped over and hurt his neck and developed acute pain in his neck and a small area in his neck. But over the next weeks, every time that nerve was pressed, the pain lasted longer and started to spread from one side of his neck to the other, to his head, shoulders, and back. And he was left with about an 8 out of 10 pain on many days, disabling. What happened was he had developed a chronic pain syndrome. Now, a chronic pain syndrome occurs when there's injury not only to the limb or the body part, but to the pain system itself. So as that nerve kept getting pressed, his pain system started to get better at or more sensitive to pain till he was what we would call hypersensitive, acutely sensitive. And this happens all the time when people get an acute pain that lasts too long. It develops an afterlife in the brain. And he realized, because he'd started to read about neuroplasticity, that chronic pain is really plasticity gone wild. When we like what plasticity does, when it allows us, for instance, to become a connoisseur of opera and we can listen to a chorus and make out all the different voices and subtleties, when we like it, it's a blessing. It makes our senses more acute. But when it applies to the pain system, it's a curse. So Moskowitz read about 15,000 pages of neuroscience to try to understand if he could somehow or other turn back his chronic pain syndrome. And as a pain physician, he knew the following. The popular misconception is that there must be a single pain center in the brain, but actually there's about a dozen of them. And most of those different pain centers don't just process pain. They process something else as well. So you may have noticed when you're in pain, you get cranky. And that's in part because there's a map that processes pain and emotional regulation. And as you go from acute to chronic pain, about 15 to 20% of that map gets hijacked to process not emotion, but pain. And the same thing goes for attention. You lose the ability to pay attention when you're in pain. And you lose the ability to do things like, turning complex images and so on in your head. So Moskowitz's inspiration was to do the following. He knew that plasticity was competitive, meaning that if you use a brain area for intensively for one thing, it'll gradually be taken over to do that one thing. So just as pain had taken over his brain maps, he would now use other activities to take his brain maps back. And because the back of the brain, there's a large part of the back of the brain that's devoted to processing visual imagery, and he knew that there were two areas that processed both visual imagery and pain. He decided that every time he got the slightest twinge of pain, he would force himself to do visual imagery. Now, this is an important point. It did not matter what he visualized, as long as he was visualizing. But because he'd never done this before, because he wasn't sure it would work, he chose to visualize three different brain scans that would remind him that the brain has its power to switch off. He imagined a brain that wasn't in pain, a scan, and that, you know, none of those areas were firing. He imagined a brain that was in acute pain, where there would be pinpricks of areas that were firing in pain. And then he imagined a brain that was in chronic pain, where those pinpricks expand into supernovas. And he just imagined, you know, dimming the switch on the pain. after the first couple of weeks, he only had moments where he was free of pain. And then after a month or so, he started to notice extended minutes. And by the end of the year, this guy, who had been tried on every known medication and every known complementary approach, was completely pain-free and off medication. And so he basically developed a mental technique to heal his oversensitive, overfiring brain of chronic pain. And then he started to use it with patients, and he's been quite successful getting some people completely off their meds, even people who still have damaged backs, or others to radically lower their medication so that they don't have nearly the side effects, the mental numbing and dulling that often goes with chronic pain meds.
It's so fascinating, and the fact that the term cortical real estate is used these days, it's just brilliant. And I think, as mentioned in your book, speaking about others who have successfully used this method, it does take a lot of work, and it's a very, very intense effort. And yet, I really do see this work of Dr. Moskowitz and some of the people that you mentioned that he's worked with. I think it's their work has some kind of invisible pathway to others. So eventually it won't take as much because we won't be so hardwired into the belief that this isn't possible, but I'm going to go anyway and try it.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, I think that's very important. Like when he did it, because he was one of the first to try this, you know, he had no confidence that this would work, except that it made a certain kind of theoretical sense based on, you know, all the reading he'd done and treating patients for years. And with the first patients he tried it with, you know, they had to do a leap of faith. I mean, this isn't a faith-based cure. It doesn't matter whether you believe it or not. All that matters is you suspend your disbelief enough to try it and do it in the correctly chosen patient. Because sometimes it's easy to confuse chronic pain, which is, again, an injury to the pain system, with recurrent bouts of acute pain. Acute pain, it says, look, pay attention. You've got to deal with this. Chronic pain can be triggered when there's no additional damage to the body part. So, but yes, I think that when people start to realize that this is an example where, you know, it's not invasive. There's no skulls being cracked open. There's no medication being used, bathing every single cell in the body, pretty much. In this case, it's the use of the mind and visualization for healing. If people understand that, it makes a big difference. And you might say, well, but gosh, he sounds like a man of extraordinary intelligence and will. Can anybody do this? Well, look, you don't have to be that intelligent or willful. If you're in deep pain, you've got somebody to keep you on task. It's your own. You've got a master, rather, to keep you on task. It's your pain. Every time you get a feeling of pain, you have to completely not try to distract yourself, but actively engage a different brain area. And he's gone on to use other kinds of activities, because not everybody wants to visualize, to sort of basically flood the brain with something, anything but the pain signal.
As you mentioned, there is a very interesting difference with placebo and then with these methods.
Yeah. You know, people often, when they hear someone dealing with, you know, a condition that's lasted for many years, like his first patient, Jan Sandin, the first patient he tried this technique with, she couldn't believe it was working. And, you know, people wondered, well, is it just a placebo effect? But placebo effects basically tend to weaken with time. And you have to really believe it'll work to some degree, or that it might work. But these neuroplastic changes tend to strengthen with time. Now, we've learned something really important from the placebo effect. The placebo effect isn't a trivial thing. It tells us that there are various switches in the brain that can be switched, and it's pretty strong for pain, for depression, for some disorders, weaker for others. But it tells us there are switches. The difference here is the turning of the switch becomes under more conscious control with the neuroplastic techniques and of these kinds. They're not all, by the way, as, requiring as much concentration and will as this particular one. This particular one is particularly intensive. There's others. You know, I talk a lot about how we can help a lot of serious brain problems by learning to speak the language of the brain, which has to do with patterns of energy and information. And some of those require, you know, mental work and mental practice, and others of them a little less so. In general, all the techniques described in the brain's way of healing, all but one, usually involve the active involvement of the patient to kind of steer the recovery. So if I could just say a few words about what I think happens in brain problems in general. When you're a medical student or a practicing doctor, you often focus on what differentiates one disease from another. And this is the genius of Western medicine, defining these differences. But you can also look at brain problems in terms of what they have in common. There are a tremendous number of brain problems, for instance, where a person can't multitask, their balance is poor, their movement is clumsy, they're prone to headaches, they tire easily, and so on. I mean, you can see these kinds of things in a traumatic brain injury, in Parkinson's, in MS, in severe learning disorders. A lot of these things will go together. We used to think that if a person had a stroke and lost 90% of the use of their right leg, that meant that about 90% of the neurons or the tracks coming from the neurons that govern movement are dead. In this book, I put forward a different formulation of that. And it's based on work that has examined EEGs and the electrical firing of the brain in a number of different conditions. Here's what I think really happens. It's not simply the case that neurons are, as is often taught in university, on or off. The only time your neurons are completely off is when they're dead. Really, neurons are usually, when they're in the on position, are firing at a faster rate relatively than they're firing when they're in the off position, when they're firing a slower rate. In some cases, it's reversed. And so what I believe happens in a number of brain problems is this. Some cells are dead. Some are sick and firing at an unusual rate, too fast, too slow, or irregularly. Some cells are receiving messages from those cells that are firing at the irregular rates. And so they can't do their work. So you've got sick cells that can't do their work and healthy cells getting junk information or data or signals that can't do their work. And with all those cells unable to do their work, the person tries to do something. They can't. And at a very unconscious level, the brain sort of learns, can't do that. This is called learned non-use. And I go into the learned non-use in great detail in my book.
It's such a brilliant and important discovery, isn't it?
Yes. It's not mine. It's Edward Taubes. What I have done, a psychologist in Birmingham who's got an incredible treatment for stroke, movement problems. But what I've done is I've applied it much more widely when it was originally applied, and spoken to Taub about this, and he agrees that it has wide applicability. So they try to do something, and the brain, quote, learns, close quote, it can't be done. And the neuroplastic brain is a use-it-or-lose-it brain. And if you don't do something over time, the circuitry tends to go dormant or waste away somewhat or be used for something else. So in interventions I'm describing, and they're all non-invasive, what you do is you use patterns of information coming in general from the senses or the body to resynchronize the brain that's firing at an irregular rate, overcome learned non-use, and awaken dormant circuitry so that it can then, when you apply it, it can be effective again. Now, how do you get the information into the brain? Actually, you just go according to nature. First of all, the brain is not really separate from the body, except in anatomy textbooks. In its functioning, it's seamlessly connected to the body through the peripheral nervous system. And so you can actually talk to the brain by doing things like moving body parts to awaken dormant circuitry. You can use the senses to talk to the brain. So we've heard a lot in the last 50 years about the very important discoveries made of the role of chemicals in the brain, serotonin and dopamine, etc. These act in the small spaces between neurons. They tend to act very locally. So, for instance, something like dopamine is very, very important in certain parts of the brain, but not in other parts of the brain. So if the chemical signaling in the brain is akin to a language, it's akin to dialect, a local dialect. But the lingua franca of the brain, the language spoken throughout the brain, within the very long tracts of the neurons, which can be as long as 3 feet, from the brain to the body, that's the patterns of electrical information from the neurons. And the way, another way to get to influence these patterns of information is to use the senses. Think of your ears. Your ears convert sound energy into electrical energy. Your eyes convert light energy into electrical energy. So ears are like the microphone that you're using, converting not only sound into electricity, but the information contained in the sound of human speech and music or any kind of sound, warning signals and so on, into patterns of information that are electrical. And you can have a very, very strong impact on electrical firing. Just to give you a couple of examples, if you're driving down the street and someone pulls up to you, in the old days it used to be in a Corvette, maybe it's some other kind of car now, with a really, really pounding song with a huge bass that's sort of like shattering your ears, you try to roll up your window, and you're still bothered. And if I was to do an EEG on you at that moment, the dominant frequency of major parts of your brain would be akin to the frequency of the music. Your brain is, your neurons are firing in sync with the music. This has been demonstrated many times.
Inspiration has never been more freeing than it is now, folks. Dr. Norman Doidge with his book, The Brain's Way of Healing, will be back next week. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. For podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.